organizers for this opportunity. And this is a joint work with Michael Ward and Junchen Wei. Michael Ward is my supervisor from UBC, and Junchen Wei is in Hong Kong. First of all, the title is a little bit different than advertised. I'm actually going to talk about both one dimensions and two dimensions. So I will start with one dimension. So let me first of all introduce the Gray-Scott model, and I'll write it on the board. It's a reaction diffusion model that has of two chemicals, well, at least two variables. I think originally it's three chemicals, but then it can be reduced to this simpler system. And for most of the talk, I will set D to be equal to 1. There's a D, I will set it to 1, just simply by scaling it out. You can scale it out. Okay. And, the important parameter, well, first of all, I said D equal to 1. The epsilon here will be small. That's a parameter that we'll be using for our asymptotic expansions. And there's actually very much depends on this parameter A. And it turns out that depending on the different scales of A, the behavior of the solutions are quite different as well. Okay, so that's the model. And notice that there's a source term. So one of the reactants is being fed into the reaction at a constant rate. Okay. So in this model, it's been studied for quite a while, quite a few people, and for probably the last 20 years or so. And it has a lot of pattern formation, so non-homogeneous solutions. Now, the classical way of seeing that there is pattern formation is due to Turing, 1950s, a very simple idea. What you do is you look at the homogeneous state, so spatially and time homogeneous state V naught and U naught, and you linearize around this homogeneous state. So you assume that this phi is some perturbation which is small, and then you solve what is the corresponding lambda, and then the M is the mode of the perturbation. And then you find essentially that it has that there is an instability band. So for mode M, this is some order 1 number, some positive number, order 1, and this is 1 over epsilon. This is quite big number. Okay, and all of those modes between some order 1 number and 1 over epsilon number are unstable. So there is an instability band for one of the, there's actually several homogeneous states for this V plus state. It's unstable. And that sort of predicts that there will be some pattern formation because the homogeneous solution is unstable. Now, however, this is not if you actually do numerical simulations, you don't see little perturbation of the homogeneous state. Eventually, the equilibrium state is very far away from the homogeneous state. So, for instance, okay. So those are some. I don't know exactly the details, but all I know is that they represent some concentrations of certain reactants in an actual chemical reaction.
And so, but the 2D model then says this is a thin layer of
right,
substrate in which these reactants
exactly
live
and react. So like some dish or petri dish. So it'll do one-dimensional case and two-dimensional case. Okay, so if we look now, here I start with a numerical simulation, this one. So I start with a homogeneous state at 3.7 something or other, and I perturb it very slightly using the sinusoidal perturbation, just sort of to set it off initially. And so, of course, after some time, the solution settles to something which looks nothing like the original homogeneous state. This settles to some equilibrium. Here's time for 100. And this equilibrium appears to be stable for a long time, but it looks very different, very far away from the homogeneous state. So actually, the type of solutions that we study, we call them spike solutions, or some people call it semi-solitons or solitons. Basically, they kind of look like delta functions. And they concentrate at certain points in the domain, and outside those points of the domain, they're exponentially small.
Those are the scale.
Yes.
Right.
So this is I started with from this 3.7 is actually the homogeneous solution, but after a while it goes away from that homogeneous solution. This homogeneous solution is unstable, but this guy is stable, in for this parameter regime. And it has nothing to do with the homogeneous solution, or at least it appears to have nothing to do with the Newman boundary conditions. Newman boundary conditions. Yeah, so the number of those spikes can vary, actually. You can have one spike, for instance, or two spikes. I'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay, so when we do the analysis, it turns out that in this scaling, there's three very important regimes. The first one, and they all basically depend on A, okay, that parameter. A somehow represents the feed rate. So we call this low feed regime, intermediate feed regime, and high feed regime with different parameters of A. Okay, so the main distinction between the three parameter regimes is the following. Okay, so basically this picture illustrates how the solution looks like for the U and the V. And as you can see here, for instance, there's two spikes, and V concentrates at this here is of extent of order epsilon, and outside this core, the core of the spike, V drops exponentially, very rapidly. Because outside the core of the spike, it's only controlled by this term and the linear term. And the nonlinear term is small outside the core of the spike. And U, on the other hand, outside the core of the spike, it looks kind of linear. Inside here, it changes at about the same rate as V changes. This is what's happening in the high feed regime when A was of order 1. And so basically, to summarize, the equations are strongly coupled inside the core of the spike, but weakly coupled outside the core of the spike.
How wide is the spike?
The spike is, the extent here is of order epsilon. Okay. Now, on the other hand, for the intermediate or low feed regime, it turns out that even inside the core of the spike, the solution actually is decoupled. So actually, even inside the core of the spike, asymptotically, U changes much slower than V. And so that allows for more analysis to be done. Okay. That's the main difference. All right. So now I'll talk about instabilities of the spikes. So the idea is, just like with the Turing instability, you start with an equilibrium solution and then you perturb from it. But now the equilibrium solution looks like a spike. And then we study its stability, so we perturb from it. And the first result is what we call overcrowding or competition instability. And that is, if your this happens mainly in the low feed regime. The result says that you can only have, if you want to have K spikes, you can only have them if your domain is big enough. So there's some thresholds which we are able to explicitly calculate, L2, L3, L4, etc., such that K spikes are unstable when L is less than LK. So, for instance, if you start with L, if you start with too many spikes, then what will happen is, as your initial condition, then what will happen is some of them will die off until L satisfies L is less than LK. Okay, and it's possible to derive an explicit formula for it. This epsilon independent, but asymptotically valid as epsilon goes to zero. So this is valid for small epsilon, asymptotically. Okay. The next instability is oscillatory profile instability. And here what happens is this is the effect of tau. When tau is small, let's say the spike is stable. As you start to increase tau, one can show that there is a Hopf bifurcation that occurs. And because of this Hopf bifurcation, what happens is that the spike will start oscillate up and down. And actually, I have a picture of this. There's a picture. There's the spikes that are oscillating up and down. Okay. And then eventually one of them gets killed. Okay. And so it seems that the Hopf bifurcation is subcritical in that the not only it starts oscillating, but the oscillations grow in size. Until it becomes too big and the spikes just gets killed. But this is an open problem to show that it's a, we don't know yet how to show that it is subcritical or supercritical. Because we just did the linear theory. For this, you have to go like one order higher. Okay. Now the next instability is the what we call the slow drift instability. So the previous two instabilities were happening at a very at order one time scale. So those spike oscillations would happen, let's say, with periodically in time, with you know, maybe time equal to 1 to 2 or to 3. So order one time they were happening. But there's another sort of another instability, which is due to small eigenvalues, which occur as sort of because of a translation invariance, underlying translation invariance of the equation. There are eigenvalues that are small, that is to say they are of order epsilon. There's an epsilon and then there's some constant in front. Okay. And these eigenvalues are responsible for a very slow drift in slow time scale of the spike. And we're able to derive an explicit formula for it. This formula is explicit, except there is this parameter alpha, which for intermediate regime, we know explicitly, it's positive. For high feed regime, it must be computed numerically. And from numerics, we conclude that it's positive, but we don't know how to do it analytically. So for some regime, for one of the regime, we can do it explicitly. For another, we have to compute it numerically. But the expression in brackets is independent of the regime, in fact. Alpha here. Oh, this is the limit. So there's B expressed in terms of A. And if I write delta is B divided by 3, when that is small, that's the intermediate regime. Then we can compute alpha explicitly. Okay. So another thing to notice is that this expression is equal to exactly 0 when L is equal to infinity. So when you have, this is on the bounded domain that we've done this. On an entire space, this expression will be exactly 0. And so that is to say the small eigenvalues are only non-zero when you have a bounded domain. That's the effect of the bounded domain. Okay, so now we have this formula. What does this formula mean? Well, we can rewrite this formula as the following. Let me just do this on the board. So here's, we rewrite this as z equal to, so z over tau equal to some function of f. Actually, Bounded domain is kind of like periodic solution because you can extend it by mirror imaging. So really, when you consider bounded solution, bounded domain, it's equivalent to considering periodic solution on the entire space. In some sense, well, not it's not exactly like that, but almost like that. Asymptotically exact, if you like, as epsilon goes to zero. Okay, so this is the formula for the small eigenvalue lambda, where z is basically, okay, so let me show you the next picture. So here's the f. It looks like this, and we know it's convex, and we know it's increasing. And then we have to see, and it doesn't intersect zero, it goes below zero, this function f, like this. And then there is the z over tau. So depending on what tau is, it may look like this, it may look like this, it may look like this. So it may have two intersections in this case, or it may have zero intersections in this case, and so on. So from this picture, we can actually, I'll skip the details, but basically, it's relatively easy to see that if I plot the lambda, this is the complex plane, and it's the plot of the eigenvalue lambda, real and imaginary part, as we change the parameter tau. Well, when tau is very small, you almost have a horizontal line which intersects this, which will intersect almost horizontal line, it will intersect this curve in two points, both of them are negative. So in that case, you have two real roots. One of them is close to zero, and another one is close to minus infinity. And as you increase tau, these two real roots will, at some point, will collide together. This is the double root here. You can have a double root, right? This curve like this, and then you have a line like this. So there's a double root at this point, and that's the point where they take off into the complex plane. And then at some later point, when tau is very big, you are in this case where you have, again, two positive roots, but now they're positive. So something like this. And so this is how the bifurcation, the lambda, this is the path of the lambda as you increase tau. You know it has two roots, both negative when tau is small, two roots both positive when tau is big. So therefore, at some point, it has to cross the imaginary axis. And that's the Hopf bifurcation. And so we can then compute this Hopf bifurcation value exactly. And so here's an example. So I set some parameter values, doesn't matter, but here's, theoretically, we predict it should be, the Hopf bifurcation occurs at 45.6. So what happens there when we do this numerically? Okay, so numerically, this is what happens. So here's the curve, this is one spike. This figure shows the position of the center of the spike versus time. So here on the horizontal axis is time, and the vertical is the position. And here I'm changing tau. This tau, this solid line, is tau is equal to 57 numerically. This is when it seems that the position is kind of stable. Okay. Then I increase tau slightly, and then suddenly the position starts to oscillate in time. This is the dotted curve. It's 66 corresponds to this dotted curve. I don't know if you can see it. It's barely visible there on this diagram, okay? But at any rate, you can see that the position oscillates in time. And also, if you look at the scale of the oscillations, this is order of, 500 or something like this. So it happens in a low, in a slow time scale. So this is slow oscillations of the positions of the spike. And as I increase it even more, when tau is too big, like this is 74, it oscillates a little bit and then just dies off. Okay? So, but then, now if you plot the height at the same time, this is the height of the spike when it's stable, just stays the same. Then I increase tau slightly beyond the Hopf bifurcation, And here it is. The height also changes. Of course, the height will change as the position of the spike changes. But if I increase it even more, here the height is changing. And then suddenly, not only does the height change, suddenly it starts to break into this fast oscillations that I've mentioned before for some time, and then it repeats like this. So in this case, both the fast oscillations happen as well as this drift instability. Okay. So here's an example with two spikes oscillating synchronously or asynchronously. So this is the positions now with two spikes. And here's another example where you have two spikes, but eventually one of them dies off, and then another one also dies off. So the first dies off, and then the other also, then the other moves very slowly, and then also dies off. Okay. So finally, I want to mention the pulse splitting instability. And again, we have a formula that predicts how many, what happens is, here's the picture. I'll just show you the picture because I'm running out of time. So this is pulse splitting. Here, starting with a single pulse, you end up with five pulses. So a single pulse splits five times until you have five pulses left. Okay. So we have a formula that predicts the number of pulses that you end up with, depending on the parameter values. Okay, so we can actually predict that the minimum number of splitting will be five in this case. Okay. And finally, this kind of analysis is applicable also in two-dimensional situation to analyze stripes. So instead of, I don't have any time, so I'll just show you a picture. Here's the picture. So here's, it starts with one stripe. Okay. Then, analogous to pulse splitting, this stripe splits into dimensions. But also what happens is, after some time, the two resulting stripes start to split, and then you can see here, this is what's called the zigzag instability. This corresponds to sort of small eigenvalues, analogous to small eigenvalues. And then you also see this breakup instability. The stripes eventually break up into spots, and you end up with just spots in two-dimensional domain. Okay. Now, in another regime, so there's actually three different instabilities that go on here. First, the splitting instability, then the zigzag instability, and finally the breakup instability. And it's possible to have just this, it's possible to have a regime where there is a zigzag instability but no breakup instability. And here's a picture. This is what happens then. Here, instead of a stripe, I took a ring, and here it has the zigzag instability, in this case corresponding to mode m equal to 4, but it doesn't really break up at any point. And so in this case, eventually you end up with something that looks like some kind of labyrinthine patterns. Okay, so I'll stop here.